Hello, and welcome to this episode of the IEA podcast. I'm your host, Darren Grimes. The 2020s will see the introduction of one of the most profoundly transformative technologies for decades, the driverless car. Today, most adults own cars that they drive daily, which they then park in their garages, their drives, or on the street, in car parks, when they go to the shops, or the train station, or the airport. They arrange repairs, they put in fuel and water and oil, they pay car taxes, and they buy insurance. Over the next decade, all of this might end, with profound implications for the way we live, but also for the public policy across a wide range of areas. Fortunately, to discuss but a few of these issues, I'm joined today by the marvellous Andrew Lillico, Executive Director and Principal of Europe Economics. Hi, Andrew.
Good afternoon.
Now, Andrew, you've written about this for the latest edition of EA Magazine, which I would urge every single one of our listeners today to go away and read. It's a magazine that we sent to schools up and down the country, and I'm sure it'll go down well, as it's a fascinating issue. But I think possibly the most basic and commonly searched question around driverless cars is, when will you be able to buy a driverless car that will work anyway? I mean, the commonly asked question contains three assumptions, doesn't it? That one, autonomous vehicles will resemble cars, that people will buy them, and they'll be capable of working on all roads in all conditions. What's your best guess?
My feeling on this is that it's probably a bit like the discussions of smartphones. So when there were, when 3G came in and you first had smartphones, people kept saying, well, it's going to be one next year or the year after. And when they kept being delayed, then there was the thought, oh, well, it's never going to happen really. And all the companies have paid far too much in the 3G auction and it was all a waste of time. And then suddenly, when they came, the first ones turn up about 2005. I had a Nokia 6330, was my first mobile phone, in fact. Within a couple of years, everybody had them. And I think it'll be much the same with driverless cars. It'll be put off and put off and then won't quite happen. And then when they come, they'll suddenly change everything.
Boom.
And it's a mistake to imagine that that these things will sort of arise gently over many decades. Well, I think we're talking about exactly when in the next decade all of this really starts to happen. I don't know, but I think that once it starts to happen, then it'll only be 2 or 3 years before it's really starting to have a huge impact.
Because you see a lot of criticisms of people like Elon Musk, who I think argued that they'd be ready to go on the market in 2017 or something like that. That over-optimism and the idea, the sense that actually people like Musk are a bit Panglossian and driverless cars are a long, long way off. You seem a bit more optimistic than that.
Well,
is there a middle ground?
Well, to some extent, I think I'm reflecting. So we did a study with the European Parliament a couple of years ago, central to which was looking at driverless cars. And we spoke to a number of the manufacturers. And at that stage, they were pretty confident that they were going to get quite a lot of impact between 2020 and 2025. Now, if that gets put off by a couple of years, it may well. I don't know. There is obviously some technical challenges and the technical questions aren't quite my area of expertise. But my guess would be that, rather like 3G, it's a thing which, okay, there'll be a few technical challenges and it may not happen exactly when people first thought, but once it comes, it's going to come and it's going to change everything. Another of the questions that you had was, who might own driverless cars? And I think that eventually what will happen is they will be owned by the fleets. That's what they're expecting. I think that the model that we should expect is cars are probably owned probably by manufacturers, and then you have some platform. It may not be Uber. Uber might be the Alta Vista to the Google of tomorrow, of whatever this new platform is, but it'll be some kind of platform where you order your driverless car. So you'll probably have a default one. So what you would probably do in practice is just say, you'll click on where you want to go. By the time you put your shoes on, the car will be there. There'll be a default one. If you want a fancy one, you could pick, you know, one that you take your date out in or something on a particular day, or you could have some different type of a car. But you'll have a default one, turn up by the time you put your shoes on, and it'll take you where you want to go, and that'll be the end of it. So it won't be that we don't need to own cars if we're just having them move us around and the vehicles are autonomous. There will be no necessity. I think that they will be owned, but probably by the original equipment manufacturers, and that they'll be hired through some kind of app platform, which is the natural future for these things. And that will also create a whole load of issues about, because we won't have insurance, because we won't need to drive. There's got to be some kind of liability structure, as I imagine we'll discuss later. Mm-hmm. And it transforms businesses like your drive. You don't need to have space for cars, particularly on your drive, just maybe for them to arrive. You don't need to have car parking spaces in town for you to leave your car. There's all kinds of implications of this, which I'm sure we'll discuss in a minute.
Absolutely. Now, as with cars, which led to road deaths, pollution and congestion, they're likely to be unanticipated and potentially unpleasant consequences for society from autonomous vehicles, such as a loss of privacy and the potential to use them as a means of social control. You do touch on this in the piece. I wonder if you wouldn't mind elaborating on what some of those potential risks attached could actually be.
Well, look, I mean, if you don't own, you don't have the same kind of a control. So in principle, somebody knows where you're going, that kind of a point. So there's some loss of privacy in that sense. Perhaps a more an interesting area here is, I think there'll be interaction between the AI and vehicles and other kinds of AI. So I imagine that within a few years, we will all have our own AI butlers, a kind of Alexa of mm-hmm. tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And your AI butlers may even last eventually across generations, carrying, as it were, your kind of family lore or your family ethics and so on. And one thing about this will be, you might have an option of your butler downloading your ethics into your AI vehicle when you drive. So what would that mean? That would mean things like, as I'm going along, do I tend to give way to an old lady if there's a chance who's in a car? Or do I give way, under what conditions, how aggressively do I drive? Things like that. So a lot of this, of course, will be structured and will be the same across everything. But you'll have across all vehicles. But there'll be some scope for you to reflect your ethical norms in the driverless car itself. And there'll probably need to be some kind of a structure eventually for you to download those into the car if you want to, rather than just taking the default societal one. Because as we all know, when we drive ourselves, road rage and all of that kind of thing, there's an awful lot of ethics involved in driving cars. And we might want to have that in the way that we drive driverless cars as well.
Well, on that point then, we assign liability on bases such as mechanical failure or driver error as it stands. But if an AI car that monitors its roadworthiness crashes, is that entirely a failing on the artificial intelligence? Where will the liability lie, I guess, in the future?
This is a profound question which insurance companies are struggling with just at the moment. So if something goes wrong, does that mean that it was misprogrammed? Does that mean that the road configuration was wrong? Should the driverless car have been able to anticipate that even so? If there's something goes wrong with the mechanics of the vehicle, the driverless car presumably should have been monitoring that. So is that in itself, by definition, is everything ultimately a failure of the AI if anything goes wrong with the vehicle at all? Yeah. And again, if suppose it's hacked by something, is that because it wasn't shielded adequately? If something goes wrong when one AI is talking to another AI, so two vehicles collide when they ought to be interleaving or whatever other kind of a thing it is that they're doing, which of them is liable for that? There are all kinds of questions here which insurance companies have got to grapple with. And there is some risk, I think, that these things become so technical that we fail as a society to have our ethical input. Because many of these technical questions have some ethical dimension. And we don't necessarily want to leave that ethical dimension to just some techie geek and whatever it is that they think the relevant ethics are, without us grappling with it enough to think of what the priorities really should be here. Because there are a number of things about norms of, is what really counts in, we would often say, in a liberal principle, if something hadn't been anticipated, then it's more liberal to have the principle that an unanticipated thing should be allowed than that it should be forbidden. What's gonna do we want to have that as a principle which we apply here to these things as well, in the way that we would want to apply that, say, in a constitutional arrangement? Mm-hmm. It's not very clear. So it's actually quite tricky to, the technical questions are tricky, but another dimension that is tricky is for us as a society to get our chance to have our input into these things before it's all so hard-coded into the whole regulatory and technical arrangement that we've missed the window of opportunity to have our say.
We talk a lot about various regulations, rules and regulations, keeping out, creating barriers to entry for new entrants, for example. Do you think, though, in this sphere, that the regulation will actually be able to keep up? Because it's clear that there'll have to be a lot of state regulation of certain ethical precepts of driverless cars. For example, whether or not the car should be programmed to plough through a cloud of pedestrians just to minimise the risk of injury to the car's passenger. I mean, what do you think about those concerns?
No, I think absolutely that there are some cases like that where it's fairly easy. So it's obvious that we're going to have some ethical precepts, and there will have to be state regulation of some of those things. Mm-hmm. But at the other end, there will have to be, I think, some scope for discretion and for people to have different sorts of values of how bullying they want to be, or how rude, or whatever other kinds of things. We need to have some scope. It can't be just, I mean, we could have that everything was just a default level and you just sat there and, you know, we don't think that we get to say how aggressive your train is, right? We just sit on the train and the train does whatever the train does. So you could say that it was entirely a matter of a default set of rules and we don't get any say. But I don't think that's by any means obvious. And I would probably prefer to have some ethical input into where these things are done. I mean, here's an example. Suppose that there were going to be some kind of a crash. How much risk do you want to bear, mm-hmm. as a person who's in the vehicle to avoid hurting a child, right? To reduce the risk that you hurt a child as you're driving. I think that different people will have different, perfectly legitimate, different priorities about that kind of a thing. And we should be able to reflect those in the way that in the ethical precepts that we put in. And there some things will have to be state regulated, but I doubt that the entire structure needs to be state regulated. There should be some scope for us to use our own thinking about these things.
Mm. Well, I wonder then, we're talking about these modern fancy technologies that all sound quite exciting. But in the current debate, if you were to go in to the Houses of Parliament, which aren't too far away from us right now, but if you were to walk into there and barge in on a debate around transport, you'd probably be met by a debate around high-speed rail. Now, I'm wondering whether or not we're having this discussion now, but all of the arguments being had are in favour of HS2, for example. It's reported we're spending £100 billion on high-speed rail, when by the time it's built, we could all be driving around in all of these app-based autonomous vehicles.
Yes, I agree. I think it's just going to render things like that irrelevant. Well, the kinds of speeds which you'd be able to go in a driverless vehicle on a motorway or in city centres will be utterly transformative. Now, I know that the HS2 makes quite a big difference to the travel times, but I think that the travel time effects of driverless vehicles are just going to be another order of magnitude again. I think that eventually we'll be talking about, on motorways, vehicles going at 200 miles an hour, that kind of a thing. They'll probably be going at 40 or 50 miles an hour through urban areas. So we're talking about absolutely transformative effects. And it's speculative, but there's a good chance, surely, that this will render things like HS2 obsolete. It's not going to be a matter of, if I can get my driverless car, am I really going to get my driverless car, get out of it, wait for the train, and then go down on the train at, you know, mm-hmm. 180 miles an hour mm-hmm. or something, mm-hmm. and then get off the train at the other end, mm-hmm. when I could just sit in a driverless car and go all the way. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense to me as an idea. Mm-hmm. I think that there is a good chance that will change everything. Now, there will be places where probably you'll retain some human leisure driving. But one other key aspect, I think, here is that the humans will probably have to be banned from driving for most places. You can't have cars going along at 200 miles an hour if you've got human drivers, because they're not going to be able to cope. You can't have cars going through urban areas at 50 miles an hour if you've got a human driver who'd struggle to do 15 miles an hour in the same area. So it's going to, they may be places, some kind of rural areas, where you'd still have, where you'll be allowed to drive as a human driver, you know, switch off the driverless thing, or maybe even have some, you know, very old vehicle, circa 2020 or something, that you're allowed to drive. The reality is going to be that the humans are going to have to be driven out. And that will involve quite a large reconfiguration of public infrastructure. Now you have to change the roads so that the surfaces and other things are appropriate for going at those speeds. You'll have to change all the city centres, so all like the traffic lights and some of the things to do with the roundabouts and all of that kind of stuff is all going to have to go, because just to facilitate, it's not going to be necessary, but it's also going to get in the way. You're going to have to think about what happens with pedestrians, so the sides of the roads and bikes, things like that. So there's going to be enormous changes. I imagine that this will be, in terms of the visible effect, one of the largest changes that we've had probably since the Industrial Revolution, in terms of the how much it makes cities look different.
With that sense of optimism and excitement, are there any other examples of artificial intelligence that you can see entering our lives that will change things on such a scale that you also reckon have the same privacy and moral concerns that are being brought about or questioned now? If you look at The Guardian, for example, The Guardian seem constantly incensed about the way in which technology is having a perverse effect on every area of our lives, whether or not that be child safety concerns, you name it, social credit systems, which we're going to get onto. But are there any other technologies that, one, you're excited by, but two, recognise there will be significant hurdles as far as policy is concerned?
So there's a lot of, I think there'd be a whole heap of AI issues in terms of other AI technologies. You'll have AI assistance. I mean, AI is going to completely transform things like audit, a whole load of all kinds of research tasks. There'll be AIs that do financial investments or already are, and then they'll have to have AIs for the regulators to chase the AI if they misbehave on the financial investment. These things are already being debated. The thing which I think is, which I find the most interesting, is the idea of personal AI butlers. My guess is that we're going to get used to the idea that we all carry around our own, I mean, I suppose in a sort of His Dark Materials way, our own daimon or demon, like our own little personal butler, that will, and it might be integrated into our family, our household butler, and the business of having an intelligent thing that watches everything that you do, and that gives you little hints, and like it says, you know, I noticed you didn't sleep very well last night. You might want to try sleeping on your right, or you've only taken so many steps this week, Darren. So maybe you might want to get down the gym little, or saying, you
possibly
know,
true.
Yeah, if I've been monitoring things, and you know, the dates you've been going on, they don't seem to be working out. So you might want to try this sort of strategy, and those sorts of things. Many aspects of your life, of your medical conditions, of your sexual status, and all kinds of other things that you might have thought once upon a time you didn't want an intelligent to come in and know in such intimate detail. I suspect that people will find routine to have their own personal butler, their AI butler. Just the notion of anything being private from your butler won't make any sense to them. It's like privacy from, I don't know, from God or something. It doesn't make any sense as an idea. I have my butler. My butler knows everything about me. Why wouldn't my butler know everything about me? So some of there's a whole series of exciting things that could flow from that. But also, obviously, you need to be able to have the right kind of shielding. I don't want my butler being hacked in such a way that it tells me to do bad things, or you could imagine all kinds of malicious things that could be done, or that my personal information is exposed by my butler, or there could be all kinds of problems associated with that. So I think that these things present their own challenges, like all great changes present their own challenges. I think it's enormously exciting, but as you probably guess, I think that some of the policy questions need to be thought through carefully.
Because if you think from there'll be a lot of libertarians listening to this podcast, and if you think about the debate going on right now around Huawei, for example, and their input within the UK's future 5G network, there'll be a lot of concerns around abuse of these sorts of new artificial intelligence. Do you think they're justifiable concerns, or do you think they're overblown? I mean, where do you stand on the Huawei question? I don't actually know the answer to that question.
Well, one of the things that is said about that is two kinds of things, I guess. One is that Huawei probably already, even before the 5G stuff, knows an awful lot about you, knows an awful lot about what we do from the systems that they're already integrated in. Secondly, is that the technical advice, as I understand it, it's not an area I have any specific technical expertise in, but that, as I understand it, the technical advice from the UK's advisors was that the bits of the 5G network which Huawei would have input into did not materially increase its ability to garner sensitive information. It didn't give them access to new bits of sensitive information that they didn't already have by the other things they were involved in. Mm-hmm. In terms of, I mean, another of the areas, the one thing that you were just mentioning a minute before, which they mentioned that China makes me think of, is the question of social credit. Because one of the really interesting things, we did a study for the European Parliament a few years ago about 2014 where we looked at social scoring creating a new form of social exclusion. So what's the idea here? The idea would be that as we have more and more parts of our lives which are facilitated via platforms of various sorts, your Ubers or Airbnb or other kinds of things, in those platforms, they will tend to have some kind of rating of you as a consumer and of you as a supplier. There are particular sorts of, when we have very elaborate rating systems, the most elaborate of which are coming financial credit, we know that there are certain kinds of issues arise, which we shouldn't forget when we're using these rating systems elsewhere. So here's the kind of thought. If you had a very large amount of life that was facilitated through these systems, and then you did something bad for a while, suppose that you had split from your partner, you have a bad month, you behave badly, you throw up in an Uber vehicle, you trash at an Airbnb house or whatever, and so you get some terrible score, you could end up in a situation where your score was so low that nobody was going to ever accept you on any of these platforms again. So you kind of enter the social credit equivalent of financial bankruptcy. Now, we have systems whereby if people want to and they apply themselves enough, they can be rehabilitated out of financial bankruptcy. You can use credit repair, credit cards and things like this, which so you can gradually work your way back so that you become reintegrated. And we propose that you might want to, that there might be a policy role for having systems whereby, as it were, you could go and paint an old granny's garage or whatever it might be, right? So you'd have socially facilitated, or maybe it's facilitated by a community action. Churches and those kinds of things might even play a role in enabling people to get a high enough score again so that they could get back in the system and use things.
Have you ever seen Black Mirror?
I have, though that came out after, the Black Mirror episode came out after our
report.
Yes, it did.
That was when it moved to Netflix,
wasn't
it?
Because people kept I would tell them about this report and everybody would tell me, oh, you've got to watch this Black Mirror episode. That was
it actually terrified me, though. You know, you've got this idea of, well, the main character in this, to give listeners the thrust, she's obsessed with her social credit system. It becomes her life, her raison d'etre. To achieve this status.
But it's also important in society because you have to have the credit of certain sorts in order to have
and
access to
and she ends up leaving society altogether, basically.
She quits,
And I wonder, do you think we'll see these sorts of moves with people rebelling against the system?
Surely you will, but you have that as well. You have people who just don't use banks and that kind of thing.
Yes.
But you'll have a few people that policy needs to deal with, the awkward squad people, but the thing which I think is of more policy significance is the more normal case where somebody ends up in a bad situation and needs to be able to rebuild their status. And what's privately optimal in terms of you're out, so I don't need to worry about you anymore, may not be the same as what's socially optimal. A second thing, of course, is that what's privately optimal in terms of avoiding mistakes maybe less. So in the same way that you have the ability to check that your credit rating is correct and try and insist that people correct errors and so on, you should be able to have access so that if there's been some malice, somebody was racist or you looked the wrong way at their girlfriend or whatever it was and they gave you a bad score and you ended up down somehow, spammed with bad ratings, the system ought to provide some means by which the score can be corrected. And so that again, I think, is a policy question. Both those things are quite important policy questions which we need to think about.
And again, that would throw up concerns for libertarians because ultimately who gets to decide what is and isn't morally good for society and what actions are and are not, I guess, virtuous, etc., and you start to get people playing the role of God almost, right?
That would be true if, insofar as the social credit rating systems themselves were centrally determined. Uh-huh. Now, I think that there might be some central input into some of them, because it's, apart from anything else, it's possible that they end up quite common. Now, we would probably prefer there to be competing mm-hmm. social credit systems of some sort. Whether they would eventually end up being a natural monopoly, I don't know. It seems plausible to me that it might. Mm-hmm. So it could be that there would be some regulation of that sort. But this is less a matter of exactly how the criteria are determined, which may have a competitive element, and more a matter of policymakers saying, whatever it is that you decide, there has to be some way for people to get back in. Mm-hmm. We can't just say, I'd rather not live in a world. I know that there are certain sorts of libertarians who say, you know, well, if you choose to, you know, become a drug addict or whatever, then that's your business. Whereas I kind of feel like if you people make mistakes, mm-hmm. and I'd rather that after people have made mistakes, there was some way back. And I don't feel like that's
redemption.
That's right. I don't think I have to be a communist in order to believe that's a right good, a good way of going.
Do you think it could be open to abuse by regimes which perhaps aren't robust democracies like our own?
Absolutely, it could. Absolutely, it could. And there'll be all kinds of problems about that. Another thing, by the way, is quite a few of these questions have an international dimension. Mm-hmm. So go back to the driverless cars again. Suppose that I'm crossing a border now. What's going to happen if the rules about ethical precepts or other kinds of things change at the border? Is it going to be that somehow as the borders cross, my AI knows that the borders cross and it switches precepts or something? Do we need to facilitate that? Would I need to have that my car was somehow had to be licensed to operate as an AI vehicle in multiple jurisdictions in order to cross? Probably we do. So there may need to be some kind of agreements that allow us to facilitate the business. Again, with insurance, am I going to be insured in multiple places? If I don't have the same liability or regimes or ethical precepts or whatever, does that mean that people have incentives to locate certain kind of activity in some countries and others? Are we going to find that, you know, if you've got certain sorts of rules, then all the auditing is done in some country, and all of the all of the medical advice is done in high risk medical advice is done in another one? These things are quite complicated, and there are all kinds of unintended consequences that are possible.
How would the social credit system work for vehicles in particular then? I mean, as far as allowing people to rebuild their scores, how do you do that around autonomous vehicles? You know, how do you prove that you're a good citizen and ensure that you can actually use your app or whatever it might be to in order to hail a car?
Yeah, it's maybe. I mean, maybe you wouldn't. Maybe hailing a car wouldn't be the first thing that you'd be allowed to do. And maybe initially you'd only be allowed to be in like the most rubbish, easy to clean inside car, or the car that was most robust to you kicking the door, or whatever other unpleasant, socially antisocial thing you might do as you got into it. I find that difficult to guess exactly what it would be. But the principle that you need to have some way in, I think, is the key thing that I would say, rather than the detail of exactly what that looks like.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if, to end, you could tell me, I mean, I already know the answer to this question, so it's a bit redundant, but you're obviously optimistic and excited. I wonder if you can paint a picture for us of just why you are filled with such optimism and excitement for the future as far as these new technologies are concerned.
Well, there's quite a few dimensions to this. One is simply the change in our visual environments. So getting rid of stuff which is sort of redundant. If a car is sitting parked all day, just being in the way, that's obviously a kind of inefficiency. So if we can get rid of that kind of a thing, that's sort of exciting. We make a better use of space. And having more trees in our cities, having more green spaces, having changing the sides of the road so it was more amenable to children and other things, having less risk of human drivers crashing into people or creating other kinds of problems. I think that's all quite exciting. But another level, the AI revolution as a whole, I suppose, as well as increasing efficiency in ways that we can't even imagine and releasing us to do new kinds of tasks we can't even imagine. I mean, I don't know what the equivalent of the retail worker right, who sits there and does your shopping as you go to today, might be in the future. Maybe it might be something like when AI are writing our poems or writing our pop music for us, maybe the AI needs somebody to listen and say, I like that bit or didn't like that bit. That could be what counts. Imagine if that were a low-skill task. Imagine that you go in only a couple of generations from the idea that what a poor person does is go under the ground and dig and die of some horrific lung disorder, mm-hmm. to only a couple of generations. Their job all day is to say what poems they like or what music or does this make me want to dance, this kind of music or something. I think that could be an enormously exciting change in the way that society, which then liberated other people to do taking out the mundane aspects of things, to do things that we can only imagine. Another dimension of this, of course, is the business of encountering an intelligence that isn't our own, not a human. It's one of the exciting things about pets, like when you look at a dog and you kind of make a contact with it in some way, you feel like it understood you. Having an AI that understood you, that knew more about you than anything else, like one of these AI butlers or something. I think that would be enormously exciting, having somebody that knew you so intimately in that kind of a way, that wasn't a human being. I think that that's, again, something which people in the future will take that for granted. But today we can see what it is that's exciting about that. And I think that there's just a whole load of very interesting possibilities that humans face in the near future.
I must say I find it exciting, but also terrifying, probably in equal measure. You know, I doubt that's a new phenomenon. I imagine that's shared quite widely, actually. But yes, thank you very much, Andrew. That was really, really interesting. Where can people find you on Twitter?
I'm at Andrew_Lillico, Lillico.
Perfect. Thank you very much. And you can subscribe to this podcast wherever it is you get your podcasts.